From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As of press time Tuesday, Israelis were still casting their ballots in tightly fought parliamentary elections. Latest opinion polls indicated that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's ruling Likud party was behind the center-left Zionist Union, led by Isaac Herzog, with one poll showing it leading Likud by 4 seats. Many of the Knesset candidates have focused on social and economic woes in Israel, such as the high cost of living. Herzog accused Netanyahu of using security scares to distract public attention from social problems. RT's Paula Slyer was in Tel Aviv Tuesday and filed this report.
Israelis are frustrated with the current situation, and while security is an important issue, many Israelis say that the issue of the economy and the fact that there has been no progress with the Palestinians is even more important. The deterioration of relations between Israel and the United States is on Netanyahu's clock, and while it's no secret that there was never much chemistry between Netanyahu and Obama, the fact that Netanyahu went to Congress and addressed the Americans, not at the invitation of the American public, further weakened the relations between these two countries. Leaked cables also show that Israel's secret service, the Mossad, is at odds with Netanyahu's position on Iran and its nuclear program. High-ranking Israeli military and intelligence officials say that they believe Netanyahu is cultivating a culture of fear through which to get support and justify his policies. They don't believe that Iran is anywhere near building a bomb. In addition to this, Israel has isolated itself on the international stage. A number of European capitals, frustrated by the lack of progress between Israelis and Palestinians, have unilaterally recognized the state of Palestine. In this respect, Netanyahu has repeatedly said there is no one with whom he can negotiate on the Palestinian side and that direct negotiations are the only way forward. But the Palestinians consistently point out that Netanyahu is hardly a willing or able negotiating partner. 4 years ago, Israelis took to this very square in protest against the high standard of living. 4 years later, Israelis say that Netanyahu has not addressed their concerns. If anything, he's only detached himself further from the Israeli public in his obsession and constant focus on Israel's security. An Israeli journalist recently said about Netanyahu that he is petty, he is cheap, but he is coated in Teflon. Paula Slyer, RT, Tel Aviv.
Representatives of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or the DPRK, known in the West simply as North Korea, rejected the findings of a human rights report prepared by a UN special rapporteur, which was presented Monday to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. The UN special rapporteur Marzuki Darusman, who was also a former official under the government of Indonesian dictator Suharto, told the assembled delegates in Geneva that well over 200,000 people, including children, had been abducted by DPRK since 1950 and called for international action as well as continued work towards reunification of the Korean Peninsula.
The Commission estimated that since 1950, well over 200,000 persons, including children, have been taken from other countries to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and many were never heard of again. While welcoming the various bilateral efforts undertaken by various countries so far to solve the issue, which should be sustained, I believe that an international approach to the issue is now required. We owe it to all the victims and the relatives who have endured enough suffering, and for the people of both Koreas to their hopes, in their hopes for a peaceful future. To conclude, there should be a renewed focus on the prospects for reunification of the two Koreas into one single nation.
But the report's primary evidence consists of testimony from a number of defectors, chief among them Shin Dong-hyuk, who was caught lying to the UN, Human Rights Watch, and others, including a number of global media outlets. According to his own statements, he purposely falsified the main chronological and geographical information in his life story, a tale of inhuman gulags in North Korea that was used as the central argument that the DPRK in the words of the UN Commission of Inquiry, is the worst human rights violator on the planet. This was Kim Jong-ho, a member of the DPRK delegation to the UN Human Rights Commission, replying to the Special Rapporteur's allegations in Geneva Monday.
As we clarified on several occasions, we neither recognize nor accept the resolutions against the DPRK and the Special Rapporteur thereof. Such mechanism is only a product of politicization of human rights on the part of the EU and Japan in alliance with the U.S. hostile policy against the DPRK, and a symbol of confrontation and distrust. We will continue to remain invariable in a position to oppose and reject it, as they are full of fabrication by few defectors from North. Those who left the DPRK after committing crimes in their motherland and were bribed to give false testimonies according to the scenario drawn up by the hostile forces.
Shindong Hyuk's sensational stories of torture and cruelty in the DPRK started to unravel late last year when his father spoke on North Korean television and said that his son had never been in a prison camp at all. His alleged life story became a best-selling book called Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Journey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. The book's been translated into 27 languages. But after the announcement by his father debunking his claims, the book's author, Blaine Harden, did some investigating on his own and issued a statement saying that he learned that Shindong Hyuk had told friends, quote, an account of his life that differed substantially from my book, closed quote. Nevertheless, the special rapporteur said he stood by the report's findings. The DPRK was supported by the Russian Federation and Venezuela in the council, who also blamed the EU, Japan, and the U.S. for politicizing the report. The foreign ministers of South Korea, China, and Japan were set to meet this weekend for their first trilateral talks in 3 years, according to a report in the Associated Press, which quoted Seoul officials Tuesday. The annual talks began in 2007, but they'd been suspended since the last session in April of 2012 due to territorial and historical disputes. The agenda of this weekend's meeting in Seoul includes ways to strengthen ties between the countries. Back in Geneva, Thursday's session of the Human Rights Council saw Paulo Pinheiro, chair of the UN's International Commission of Inquiry for Syria, say that civilians continued to be the deliberate target of barrel bombs, mass executions, and sexual violence as the conflict enters its fifth year. Pinheiro detailed crimes by all parties involved in the fighting before saying that the names of those believed to be responsible for crimes would not be made public just yet. He criticized the lack of international response and repeated the need for a political solution to the crisis. Daniel Johnson has more.
Massive recurrent violations of human rights that deliberately target civilians still happen in Syria, Paulo Pinheiro told the Human Rights Council on Tuesday. The investigator and Commission of Inquiry chairman spoke of women and girls abducted by Islamic State fighters in Iraq and then sold and resold inside Syria as sex slaves and war booty. The extremists also continue to throw men accused of being gay off tall buildings, Pinheiro added, before condemning the Syrian government for bombing and killing tens of thousands of civilians. He also condemned the stalling that has prevented the UN Security Council from referring the situation to the International Criminal Court.
This war is a chronicle of missed opportunities on the part of states with political influence and the broader international community.
And on the issue of whether to release the names of those believed responsible for crimes, Pinheiro said they would not be made public, but instead shared with states interested in prosecuting citizens. Daniel Johnson, United Nations.
But the representative from the Syrian Arab Republic, Hussam Eddine Allah, sharply criticized what he called the, quote, biased and selective approach, closed quote, of Pinheiro's investigation, which he said ignored the massive brutal crimes by insurgent groups. Responding to the report at Tuesday's council session, he rejected the findings, saying they, quote, defy the standards of credibility, closed quote.
Shukran.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Mr. Pinheiro has exceeded the time for him, and I hope that we will be treated on an equal footing. The selective and politicized practices of the reports of the Commission of Inquiry is quite blatant, and it defies the standards of credibility which the Commission should respect. The report before you recycles previous accusations and previous reports, which are based on flawed standards and questionable working methods, and therefore raises questions as to the credibility of the conclusions. In fact, they are based on one-sided narratives from people who belong to armed groups that are hostile to Syria, and one-sided narratives from unknown sources but well-known with well-known motives. And the report neglects to take into account the suffering of civilians and has neglected to take into account the information provided by the government. We are not surprised by this behavior, as it coincides with a predetermined agenda of the Commission, which was completely submissive to the will of the states who sponsor terrorism and slaughter the Syrian people. The Commission's biased and selective approach and its continued accusations towards the government of Syria while turning a blind eye to the crimes of other terrorist groups such as the Nusra Front and considering the Nusra Front as an armed opposition group, which is contrary to the classification of the Security Council as a terrorist organization, leads us to doubt the credibility of its motives. Dialogue has become an absurdity. The report refers to Daesh as an armed opposition group without any legal standing. The report refers to the crimes of Daesh. Mr. Pinheiro has not spoken of Daesh, and in the report there has been confirmation of the external support received by Daesh. The Commission's report and its recommendations remain silent as to the responsibility of states such as Qatar, Saudi Arabia and Turkey in sponsoring terrorism, and the reports have also confirmed that charity organizations also are funding extremist entities and has violated Security Council resolutions. The report remains silent as to the responsibility of Turkey in allowing these terrorists to enter Syria through its borders and its responsibility in smuggling stolen Syrian oil in order to sell it and fund terrorist groups. The Commission insists on accusing the government of targeting civilians. These are far from the truth.
This is part of claims that there is failure to protect civilians in order for that to be used as a pretext for foreign intervention under humanitarian cover. My delegation commends the Commission of Inquiry for its neglect of the effect of unilateral coercive measures on the humanitarian situation. They are tantamount to violations of human rights. We also reject strongly the other allegations about the use of chlorine gas. This is unacceptable. This is also a way of prejudging the results of investigations of OPCW, which is in charge of investigating such cases. It is a flagrant interference in the competence and mandate of OPCW. Syria submitted to OPCW documents that confirm the involvement of terrorist organizations in the use of chlorine gas, and it continues to cooperate with the OPCW in investigating these cases. The COI interprets its mandate in a way to expand its scope and includes selective recommendations. It also has in its reports what goes beyond the decision of the Human Rights Council, which set it up and addresses other UN bodies. We believe that the COI has deviated from the principles of independence, neutrality, and professionalism. That is why we reject its reports. Thank you.
Meanwhile, the U.S. again faced heavy criticism from the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture over yet another aspect of its criminal justice system, this time because it sends children to prison for life sentences. The U.S. is the only country in the world that does this. RT's Marina Portnaya gives us a closer look.
The United States is once again being singled out on the global stage for its detention practices, and it has nothing to do with suspected terrorists. A United Nations report on child detention notes that the U.S. is the only nation in the world to imprison children for life without the possibility of parole, which some interpret as being a death in prison sentence. The practice is also banned under several international laws.
I believe that the detention of children must always be a last resort, to be used only for the shortest time possible, and only if it is in the best interest of the child.
According to the Sentencing Project, about 2,500 individuals, 2,500, are currently serving out mandatory life sentences behind bars for crimes they committed as children.
A juvenile may not have been the so-called trigger man in a homicide that occurs, but depending on state law, they might all go down for the same crime and all get life without parole.
Dominic Culpepper was 15 years old when he was sentenced to life in prison in 2002 for beating another teenager to death. His mother says the justice system should be rehabilitating young boys instead of forcing them to live and die behind bars.
I don't want him to get a slap on the wrist at all. I agree that he must serve, but I don't want to see his life thrown away for the rest of his life behind bars.
In 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court outlawed mandatory life sentences without parole for kids under 18, deeming the practice unconstitutional. However, judges at the state level still technically have the power to send a child to prison for life.
If America could be sending so much messages to the world that we are the greatest nation, then why do we do these things?
RT reached out to the Department of Justice asking what actions the U.S. plans on taking to comply with international law of child detention. We were referred to the State Department, which then referred us back to the DOJ. In the meantime, the U.N. has kicked off its Stop Child Torture social media campaign aimed at ending the harmful conditions kids experience when locked behind bars. Marina Portnaya, RT, New York.
Issuing life sentences for children is banned under numerous international laws, including the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention Against Torture, and the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which the U.S. and South Sudan are the only two states to have signed but not ratified. Also, a UN oversight body has found that the sentences violate the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, since youths of color are more likely to receive the sentence than white offenders. Socialism was knocked down but not out with the collapse of the Soviet bloc 25 years ago. That collapse, however, didn't change the fact that capitalism is in its late stages, with evidence mounting that it may be on its last legs. So said columnist and political commentator Danny Haifong in his latest piece, appearing in this week's BlackAgendaReport.com. We spoke with him via Skype Sunday. Tell me about this week's story about socialism.
Well, on Black Agenda Report, I submitted an article entitled Socialism is Still the Way Forward, Combating Neo-Imperialist Lies. And the point of the article was to basically explain that despite all that has happened within the last, especially the last 30 years of the neoliberal period, we still see that socialism, it remains not only an inspiration to the world's people and oppressed people all over the world, but also it remains an objective reality that we have to come to grips with, especially with the severe lock that imperialism has on alternatives to the system. So, you know, I started out talking about how there was a long history before the neoliberal period that basically brought on a crisis of the imperialist system. I talk about how, you know, Fred Hampton was only 21 years old before he was murdered in 1969 as a member of the Black Panther Party, where he talked about socialism being the people. If you're scared of socialism, you're scared of yourself. I think we see a lot of fear in the United States around the idea of socialism, partly because so much anti-communist propaganda was pushed into the brains of working and oppressed people in the United States, but also because of all the changes that have occurred since the Black Panther Party was crushed. The neoliberal period has brought on a huge reactionary swing in political direction that we have to look at, especially given the fact that there is a real push right now around the world to create an alternative to imperialism and capitalism. And we see that especially in Latin America, and I think it's especially relevant today with all that's happening with the Obama administration saying that Venezuela is a threat to national security and trying to ease up relations with Cuba, despite the fact that it's had a near five-decade embargo on it, trying to crush the socialist system there. So there's just all sorts of connections that I think socialism still makes, and it's still the way forward in terms of where we have to go and what we have to discuss in order to bring the system down.
You know, looking at, you brought up Venezuela, for example, so that I think it's a really good example, actually. Venezuela, you have the election of Chavez in 1998, and just very briefly, the context for that was the special period for Cuba. Cuba survived with the assistance of the Soviet Union until December of 1991, and then it received nothing from anybody and was cut off by the U.S. embargo, and they had to tough it out. And everyone thought that would be finally the bring down of the revolutionary government in Cuba. When that didn't happen, in 1998, Chavez gets elected and starts assembling this regional construct based on solidarity, respect for sovereignty, self-determination, and control of your own resources. They engaged Cuba and threw Cuba a lifeline and then began to move out using Petrocaribe, doing that around the region, where now the U.S. and IMF and the influence of all these neoliberal and imperial structures has been kicked way back and is being supplemented by trade with China and soon with Russia. That is a threat to, it is a threat to the security, not the national security in the sense that they declare it, but to the security of the imperial construct. And Venezuela has now started to reach out using the same tools they used in this region to Greece and ultimately to Spain after the elections there. But the relative balance of forces is not fully developed yet, I guess is a probably most accurate statement of it. What do you see happening through this period that we're going into?
The future is definitely hard to discern at the moment, but I think everything that you talked about was accurate and a positive development. It's interesting that the Obama administration, Obama himself, declared Venezuela a threat to national security only months after Venezuela and China agreed to invest billions of dollars in mutual aid with each other, and how it seems that wherever China goes to do investment in the United States reacts in a way that is either so-called diplomatic with Cuba, because I know that China was also in Cuba right before it started to ease up relations. And then we see after China makes its tour through all Latin America and especially focuses on what Venezuela's huge oil capital could do for China's industrial development, we see now that the United States is taking an even harsher response to the country that dates back years with the overthrow of Chavez for a few days, with the constant war it has conducted covertly through fascist forces in the country. I think the future that I talk about in my article is hard to see, because a lot of forces have been beaten back since the Soviet Union fell in 1991. Eastern Europe came under fascist dictatorship control in much of the region. We see that the North Korea became so much more isolated to the point where, although it's been able to beat back things like embargo and sanctions that seek to starve out the country, it's been able to to feed the people. The people have been able to feed themselves and get out of such a dire situation. But we still see a lot of isolation. I think what's happening through the development of a multipolar world is that although we don't see maybe a clear, concrete socialist direction worldwide, we do see a block of nations. So whether it's socialist mixed economies like Iran, Russia and China, we see a convergence of these forces that is weakening the influence of imperialism and potentially bringing more political space for working class and oppressed people to chart their own path and direction. So, in my article, I try to explain that we need to really understand what socialism is. We need to really understand that it is about an overthrow of private property, of imperialism, of the parasitic class that exploits the labor of the world's people. And it's a transition of power like what happened in Venezuela, where now the masses control the state. And they don't just keep the state as it was, but they transform it so it meets the needs, the basic needs of the majority of the people. That's exactly what's happened in Venezuela. That's exactly what happened in Cuba in 1959. That's what happened in Korea. During the Korean War and the transition to socialism there, and the forced division of the country in Vietnam, and we still see these forces struggling for survival, and we need to understand that that's an objective reality, and we can't just ignore socialism as a system that is still under attack in a period where imperialism is declared an end of history, and we see how desperate it is, and it's not as dominant as it said it was just a couple decades ago.
Looking at just the investment and construction and development projects that are underway, clearly the plan is among the BRICS countries and among the Mercosur countries here for some very deep integration on a global scale, because you're looking at the investment in just transportation alone between the construction of the canal through Nicaragua, the construction of deep water ports in Cuba and on the west coast of South America, and all the way over even to Ecuador and other countries, Brazil, transcontinental railroad in South America, and then a railroad from the ports in China to Moscow.
Yeah.
Could service trade activity among those countries, say, in one or two orders of magnitude above where it is now.
Right. Yeah. All of these developments are scaring imperialism, and especially the United States at its head with the crisis. It's already well known that the United States has fallen below China's GDP. If we factor in, an adjustment to inflation and the dollar, which is heavily inflated and at this point, an inaccurate assessment of what the capitalist economy is actually producing in the United States. And so this economic decline that the United States is experiencing all over the world, and this boom that China is still experiencing despite all the numbers that economists are peddling about how, China's also on the decline because it's pegged to the capitalist market. But we are seeing that China's, vast difference in development around the world is producing conditions that threaten the only thing that the United States and its Western allies can do at this point, which is try to completely clamp down on the world's production through finance, capital, debt, the IMF, World Bank, as well as Wall Street institutions. The only thing it can do is straight plunder the wealth of the world, and it really can't do anything else but that. And all of China's development around the world through mutual partnership with Latin America, with Russia, all of that threatens U.S. imperialism's ability to live another day. And so it's unleashing its military around the world, and this is the development we're going to see.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.